with Nina
and Clara.
And this is our first episode of this podcast, but hopefully we will produce more in the future. Today's episode is discussing Jordan Peele's horror film Us in relationship with Toni Morrison's 2008 novel A Mercy. And both of us have seen Us over spring break, so it's been a minute.
Yep.
But that does not hinder.
Still haunts me.
Yes. Clara has not read A Mercy, but I will do my best to give a good synopsis and to do Toni Morrison justice. First on the docket, we're going to start discussing Us because that's what we both know and love. Creep on in, on in, on in.
There's a family in our driveway.
It's probably the neighbors.
But y'all scared of a family?
Hi, can I help you?
Zora, put your shoes on.
If you want to get crazy, we can get crazy.
So, Us is a new horror film by Jordan Peele. And it focuses on a black family, primarily, mother, father, two kids, affluent, they're on vacation.
Summer vacation.
Yes. And the movie begins with a flashback of the mother as a child, and they're on the Santa Cruz Pier, and Adelaide runs off by herself into a funhouse, and it's titled Find Yourself, ironically.
Oh, yes.
And at the beginning of the film, we just see her in the funhouse seeing an exact double of herself, which is not a reflection.
Do we know it's not a reflection in the beginning, though?
Yeah, because she sees the back of her head.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then she turns around.
I'm getting chills right now. Oh, that's right. Oh.
Currently, we are driving through rural Iowa, and
this is adding to the scare factor, I'm not going to lie.
Luckily, it is light out.
Yes, true.
Flashes back forward, the family is on the same exact pier.
And also, the mother is, like, freaking out, like, mm-hmm. in present time, and her husband doesn't really know about any of that, nor does her children, but he's kind of like, why are you freaking out?
So. Right, exactly. And so, they are vacationing, they're having a relatively good time, and one night, after Adelaide kind of explains why she's so freaked out, Adelaide's son, Jason, informs them that there's this family at the end of the driveway, and it appears to be exact doubles of all of them.
And it is.
It is. And so that's kind of just the general premise, but there's so much more. But first, I just wanted to ask you, which parts of the movie stuck with you the most?
Ooh, okay. So first, when I was, like, trying to remember the film and all that stuff again, and, like, listening to the creepy music, one of the things that I remember was, like, was it, her son's name was Jason,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the, like, match, how we would always be playing with that fire starter match thing.
Yes.
And then, we're spoiling things, right?
Yes.
And then when they reveal his, like, double,
mm-hmm.
it's, like, the boy, he wears a mask for most of the film,
mm-hmm.
but they finally reveal his face, and it's very, like, scarred and fire damaged, and mutilated,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of realize that, like, the actions of the upper world people, like, the lower world people, like, still experience the repercussions
mm-hmm.
of those, kind of. What did you think of that? I don't think we ever talked about, like, what that meant.
Yeah, so, generally, the premise of these doubles are that they were created by the U.S. government as a project to control the people above.
Yeah.
So their purpose was to duplicate these bodies and these spirits to essentially control everyone.
Yeah.
It failed, and they were abandoned. The people down below were abandoned.
Which I think that's such, that in and of itself mm-hmm. is so much to dissect.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I mean, that's a greater commentary on our government and so many failed projects and, like, they're just throwing people by the wayside because they're no longer relevant. Oh, there's so many things.
So much. And so these people have been living these exact, well, they're mirroring the people above, but
ghost
with horrible circumstances. They're eating raw rabbits.
I forgot about that.
They're doing everything kind of off. Like, everything kind of seems a little sideways. When you see the underground, they're kind of mimicking the people in roller coasters and eating, like, the carnival foods, and it's just super creepy. But Jason, specifically as a character, we can discuss for hours, because his doppelganger is the one with the scarred face, and that pairing is really weird because it seems like Jason can control the doppelganger. Yes.
Ooh, I just got more chills.
Yeah, the way other characters couldn't.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of speculation about that as to why. A lot of fan theories.
Why do you think?
Well, so, okay, I got sucked in to a dark hole of theories, and what I believe is that Jason is actually a tethered.
Like, you think he's a
the mom
person.
Yeah.
But how would that work? How?
So the theory is they had gone back to this vacation home like a year or two earlier, and somehow he was switched. There's not a huge amount of evidence
Wasn't the mom, like, super anxious about Jason because he'd been lost before?
Yes. Like, she was so protective of him the whole time.
That's right.
Like, it, you know, even in the trailer, she says, "Where's Jason?
Where's Jason?"
Jason?
Jason!
Where were you? I didn't know if you were lost. Stick with me, and I'll keep you safe.
I wonder if she switched them out because she...
She knows.
But did she know she was tethered the whole time?
Yes.
Then how was she able to act so surprised?
Because it had been so long, I think. Because
she just started to believe that that was her real life. I mean, it was her life.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I mean, are you talking about Red or Adelaide?
I guess Red... I'm talking about tethered and non-tethered, because Red is technically non-tethered.
Yes.
And Adelaide is tethered.
Yes.
So I'm talking about Adelaide.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, she knew that she had switched her and the other
Right. So
girl.
I'm thinking maybe she wanted to switch.
Yeah.
Her son.
Yeah. So the theory is that he was switched recently, because there's also allusions to the fact that he has been acting differently. They talk about that briefly at the beginning, how ever since, like, his grandmother passed away, he's been acting really weird.
But then, why would it be that the tethered or the non-tethered would have all the face scarring and, like, couldn't talk? And do you think that has something to do with the idea that when you bring, like, a non-tethered down to the tethered world? What do you think?
So, the theory around that is that somehow his mouth had been, like, burned, basically.
Oh, to, like, shut him up.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Which is a little bit of a stretch. Like, I think this whole thing is a little bit of a stretch. But I do think it's very, very weird that Jason, the whole time, was not reacting to anything.
True.
Like, he never seemed scared. He never, like, questioned any of it. He just kind of went along with everyone else and, like, killed whoever he needed to kill.
And yeah, that's true.
Was not even fazed. Whereas,
but I mean,
like,
the daughter also killed.
Right, but the daughter was, like, crying.
That's true.
And, like, scared. But, like, when...
But another thing is, when you're that young, you can't fully process what's going on. I mean, still,
that's
even
true.
At the daughter's age. But when you're that young, sometimes that all of that trauma is internalized.
Yeah.
Just like what happened to Red / Adelaide.
No, that's
when
true.
When she was really young.
That's true.
Tangential.
Very tangential. But then, the last moment of the film, when Jason clearly knows.
They do, like, a knowing look to each other.
Yeah.
Adelaide and Jason. Oh,
yes.
My goodness.
So it can be seen as, like, oh, he knows that she's a tethered.
But also, but also he found out, didn't he? Because
he did, yeah.
Right.
So it could be interpreted both ways, that he just knows that she's a tethered now, or that he is in on it.
Oh my gosh.
Which is really creepy. But
are you getting chills? Like,
yeah.
I'm, okay, good.
Well, so I've, like, I feel like I've analyzed this movie.
True, you knew
so
all of that.
Much.
That was all news to me. That
yeah.
was, okay.
I've watched all the YouTube videos. All right. But
you're an expert. We get it.
No, it's okay. That part of it has also struck with me because it's like this little question that Peele leaves in
yeah.
to be like, you know, mysterious.
I mean, he leaves in so many. The other thing
yeah.
I was gonna say when you asked me what stood out to me was the hands. What was that thing called?
Hands Across America.
Hands Across America. And that, like, constant imagery over and over
yeah.
again. The film, like, when it ends, that's something you kind of think of as an afterthought of, like, wait, what was that? You know what
yeah.
I mean? Because there's, like, the ending is just such, like, a, oh, my goodness. You're only thinking about that. And then later you're like, wait a second, what was that?
Yeah, yeah. I remember walking out and being like, I feel like that didn't even matter. But then you start thinking about it as, like, this other kind of governmental
yeah.
project.
It goes back to that again.
Yeah. That represents, like, standing up for a marginalized group, but really didn't do anything.
Right. And then it's forgotten.
Yeah.
Just like it's forgotten when we walk out of the... Ooh.
Yeah.
Peele is a genius.
He is.
Yeah.
He really
is.
I think also what stuck with me was the imagery of the elevator that only went down.
Oh.
And there was no up.
There was no up.
There was no up elevator.
Yeah.
And I think there were stairs, but
yep,
there was only a down escalator.
Yeah.
And so that really represents, obviously,
yeah.
like, downward mobility and, like, the...
How easy it is to go down.
Yeah, yeah.
How hard it is.
Stairs obviously take more effort to go up. So much class commentary. And then, like, the representation of the tethered in those uniforms.
Yep.
As, like, prisoners.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy-handed, but
yeah.
it still gets that
yeah.
jarring point.
Yeah. So, anyway. So, I think the most obvious kind of scholarly interpretation of Us that has been made has been connecting the movie to the idea of double consciousness, and that was coined by Webb Du Bois, and he kind of theorized that there are always two beings, or I guess two personalities conflicting for Black Americans, one of them being their Blackness and one of them being their Americanness,
mm-hmm.
and kind of how to navigate that conflict, as well as how to function in a world that doesn't see that and that looks Black Americans over because they don't qualify as valid Americans in a lot of people's eyes. So it's constantly justifying both of those identities
yep.
against the idea of whiteness and this, like, white gaze that is put upon Black Americans.
After the Egyptian and Indian, the Greek and Roman, the Teuton and Mongolian, the Negro is a sort of seventh son, born with a veil and gifted with second sight in this American world, a world which yields him no true self-consciousness, but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder.
And so this idea, I think, is literalized in the movie as the being and the doppelganger, but also I think on a ideological level, the doppelgangers represent kind of what could have been their lives and how their lives could have been in another universe that's kind of paralleled versus what their lives actually are.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I think, that Peele makes the family seemingly upper class, like at least wealthy enough to have a vacation home and to take this vacation many times with their family. I think class has a huge factor in double consciousness, according to Du Bois, in that the higher you climb in the social and economic ladder, the more you come against this double consciousness idea. Yes. And the more you see it, because you're put in those spaces that point out your blackness and question both of those identities. So the fact that the family is haunted by these doppelgangers is like, not even people who have the affluence can escape that duality factor, and even maybe are even more affected by that.
It's interesting too, because with the idea of like double consciousness, the two, like the tethered and the non, both want that same thing. Like they're both striving for that same thing, or else they wouldn't keep going back to that place, right?
Yeah.
But like, obviously, the one has those, the barrier of being tethered.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an interesting, like, because it's still like that internal, like, fighting with your own self.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, and the idea that the government project failed was that they could duplicate a body, but they couldn't duplicate the soul.
Totally.
So the soul of the tethered is non-existent, essentially.
Yeah, because it's just tied to...
Well, I guess...
You think?
I don't know.
Or do you think it's just like a non-souled body?
That's actually a good question.
I kind of thought it was like a copy.
Yeah.
In the way that a double consciousness would be, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, that like...
And that's why they're wanting the same thing, because it's the same soul, but split in a way.
Yeah, and that the only difference between the tethered and the non-tethered...
is the barrier.
Yeah, and also, like, love and, like, care, you know? Like, the tethered are surviving in these horrible circumstances with... no affection and no love and no kind of care.
No, I would say, but it's interesting because here's my question. There's obviously no external care. Like the people taking care, like whoever's feeding them raw rabbits, like obviously don't care. But is there care like within the family of the, like the family dynamic of the tethered?
Mm.
Like is Red caring for like the tether of Jason? What's the other child's name? I don't even know.
So the tethered versions of the characters, Jason's tethered is Pluto.
Okay.
And Zora's character is...
We don't have Google right now.
I know.
We're in a dead zone. Whatever. It doesn't matter.
I'll insert it later.
Yeah.
But what were we saying?
I was asking about, like, the family dynamic of the tethered.
Yeah. So,
and, like, was there any sort of nurturing love there?
Mm. So when the two families are sitting across from each other and Red is kind of explaining like the story of how they got there, kind of, she describes each family member, and both of the children she describes as like monsters. Like she describes Jason, or I guess Pluto, as like a monster of fire or something like that. And the daughter as another kind of like demon of like pain.
But could that also be because she was a non-tethered, trapped in the tethered world?
Mm.
And also, if you think about it, if the mother, right, the mother is the tethered, the mother of the non-tethered world is actually the tethered.
Mm.
But she wanted, if that other theory you talked about is true, Jason's tethered form, Pluto, to be in the upper world with her, then that would be a sign of some sort of nurturing love attachment, wouldn't
That's
it be?
That's true, yeah. But because Red was truly untethered, she was a human, she wasn't like any of the rest of them.
That's true.
So, like, is that unique to her because she came from above?
It's also interesting because you look at origins in the story, and in from one perspective, you're like, well, it doesn't matter that she came from the tethered, because mm-hmm. she is, like, the embodiment of human.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Right, and then it brings in the question of who is good and who is evil, right? Because you're confronted with the fact that you've been rooting for
the one who switched him out.
Yeah, essentially a villain.
But then it's like, well, why are you villainizing people who were tortured by the government, right?
Yeah.
Like, they should not be the villain of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Either.
And did her best to take advantage of her options and move upward in the ladder, basically.
Yeah, just put yourself in that story.
Mm-hmm.
Would you do the same thing?
Right, you're forced to eat rabbits and you're...
And you have that opportunity to, like... And you're so young, too.
Right, and you don't understand any of it.
You don't know how to make an ethical choice at that age, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Mm.
Yeah, well, there's also a thing of the tethered would never have staged that revolution if it hadn't been for Red. Because Red was the only one with language.
And she was she the only one who knew about the upper world?
Yeah. So she informed them about, like, this other way better world that they were deprived of. And so that's how she became that figure, that leader, to kind of convince everyone to take that back.
Yeah, because she even talked about that when she had her, like, big monologue at the end of, like...
In the classroom.
I taught them how to be...
Yeah, yeah. And she was standing at the front of the classroom like a teacher.
Yeah.
And cutting the hands of America...
The paper chain.
Yeah.
That's true.
Super creepy.
Very much so.
Yeah. But I think the idea of, like, affluence as not the only way out, I think that's really interesting. Like, their social status, like, Adelaide's family's social and economic status did not exclude them from being haunted and being hunted by the tethered. And so I think that connects a lot with Du Bois' idea of, you know, class isn't everything and, like, money isn't everything.
Right.
And no matter how much money you will have,
you can't escape that trauma.
Yeah. You'll always have that conflict, which I think Peele clearly points out in a lot of moments about their blackness and about the differences between them and their white friends in Santa Cruz, and they're very subtle, but they definitely matter in, like, the larger plot as a representation of blackness playing a role.
Right, and you know, like what we were talking about earlier with if they had taken race out of the equation of that movie, mm-hmm. would it have, like, been a similar idea?
Yeah.
And, like, I think because of those subtle nods to, like, black history, and then also just, like, the things that black people struggle with today, mm-hmm. being, like, in a white supremacist society. Like, just when when she goes to call the cops and he's like, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, like, without those things and the idea that it would have been a reverse role,
mm-hmm. in another horror film.
Right. They would have been the ones getting murdered.
Yeah, immediately.
So that and then that adds a whole nother side to the entire idea of, like, the duel.
Yeah. I think, like, I walked out of the movie feeling really confused and, like, almost gypped of, like, a very clear plot. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, when I saw Get Out, it was, like, straightforward.
Obvious.
You know, like, race taking, you know, black bodies for whatever you want to make them. And that was easy. But for this one, I was like, why did he include the white people? Like, did he just do that to be accessible to a lot more people and not alienate white people as much? But I think, like, the idea of looking at trauma and enslavement as not necessarily a black thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of the times a black thing, which, you know, the main characters are obviously the black family.
Right.
And those are the ones who make it out.
Right.
I think that's super interesting in thinking about slavery and the history of it affecting everyone.
Yes.
Rather than just black Americans. Because this huge global experiment of slavery was a choice that impacted every single race in every single country.
Yeah.
Whether or not, you know, we wanted to. But then that trauma follows everyone in a certain way.
Oh, yeah.
That leads us nicely into the portion about mercy. And this is the part that Clara has not read. But that might be even more interesting as a discussion of something that you don't know a ton about. So, A Mercy is one of Toni Morrison's more recent novels. It was written in 2008, or I guess published in 2008. And it was one of her earliest set novels. So most of her works talk about slavery and talk about the slave experience, but this novel happens even before kind of the huge movement towards the transatlantic slave trade. It kind of tackles slavery as a non-racial element in the story, and it takes place in the late 1600s, early 1700s, and it tells the story of a bunch of different characters on Jacob Vark's farm. And Jacob Vark was a white trader of some kind, and his business was not slaves at first, and he looked down upon the slave trade, but then he kind of got gypped in like a business deal, and the guy he was doing business with offered him a slave in return to like make up that debt. And so then he chose this girl who we know as Florence, and she was a really small child at the time, and he picked her as kind of a form of mercy, of like, I can give her a better life than she would be living on this plantation with all of these other slaves. And so at first he does it out of kindness, question mark, or what he sees as kindness. But this kind of opens the door to more slave trade, and he realizes the value of, you know, acquiring people to work his farm and build more houses. And
scary how that happens.
Yeah, especially, so the book is also told from all the different characters' perspectives at one point or another, and in his chapter, he really, like, he's disgusted by slavery, and he says only lazy people buy slaves and, you know, require them to work, and, like, I don't deal in that business. And then by the end of the chapter, you can see the greed in him.
That's a kind of different type of duality in and of itself.
Yeah, definitely. And so you see that shift in realizing the value of having slaves, which is repulsive to read. But the perspective of the book is really interesting because it alternates between Florence, who's now, I think, 16, and she is chasing after this man who she's fallen in love with, who she calls the blacksmith. And so we hear her perspective every other chapter, and then the other chapters are told by the other people on the farm. And then since we hear from Jacob at the very beginning of the book, he's died. So he's, like, not even a main character. And he's also kind of haunting his farm, which is another form of kind of the past haunting the present. But the story is mostly about the female slaves on the farm, as well as his wife, who is still living, but she's very sick. And it tells the story of all their journeys to that farm and their respective enslavements. So it includes a perspective of a Native American slave, Lena, It includes Rebecca, the wife's story, who is white, and she came to America on a boat with a lot of other European women to be sold as brides, another form of slavery. And then it tells the story of Sorrow, who is a mixed slave. I don't remember if they specify what her exact ethnicity is, but she's at least partially black. And she was found by Jacob in a boat, I believe, or some sort of not great situation, which is why he names her Sorrow. So that's interesting in naming, you know, someone else who is already a person. But anyway, so she is called Sorrow, and she is not well liked on the plantation at all. The other women think that she's cursed because the wife, Rebecca, had a baby, and the baby died as soon as Sorrow came. And so all these things, she's very alone, but she has this being with her that she calls Twin, and it's essentially a doppelganger, but no one else can see her. Only Sorrow can see Twin. And Twin kind of whispers things in Sorrow's ear and spends time with her and kind of gives her reassurance.
But, like, what types of things is she whispering?
So, she isn't super... She doesn't explain a lot in a lot of words, but whenever Sorrow is upset, Twin is always like, you are, like, much better than them, and, like, they are doing all these things to be mean to you, basically.
I see.
So she, like, kind of...
It's like a nurturing, but in a kind of a creepy way.
It's very creepy.
Okay.
Yeah, and in, like, a not great friend kind of way, like, wanting Sorrow to believe certain things about herself, and it seems like she has good intentions, but it's also very twisted. Okay. So Twin has been with her... I think since Jacob found her, it seems like when Jacob found Sorrow, Twin arrived, which seems like a form of trauma, being taken as a slave. Sorrow also had a baby, so she was pregnant, and she went into labor, and Lena, one of the other slaves, helped her give birth, but Lena told Sorrow that her baby had died, but really, Lena killed her.
Whoa!
Yeah. So, Sorrow doesn't really know that, but it's kind of clear to the reader that Lena did something with the baby and killed the baby.
But why? Why did she kill it?
Because Lena believed that Sorrow was, like, evil.
Okay.
And
wow.
So, like, the spawn of her was evil.
Wow.
And I believe that Twin kind of knows that, too, that happened. Mm. And so, later on, Sorrow becomes pregnant again and gives birth completely on her own. And she delivers the baby, and the baby is healthy, and she realizes that that is the first time that she's done anything independently without a man to help her, and, like, without anyone, really, but especially a man, because her life has been run by men and by being owned. And so the minute that this child comes into being, Twin disappears. And so there's possibly an element of bringing a new life in and then getting rid of another, but also the fact that Twin was acting as a dependent being while Sorrow was not at all independent, and the minute that Sorrow became independent, Twin didn't have a purpose anymore. So super weird, kind of unclear as to why Morrison included that element, because Sorrow's the only character that has, like, a doppelganger-esque thing with her. And there's really not a ton of scholarship about that at all. Partially because I think it's a relatively new novel, but also it's kind of a minor part of the book.
Yeah.
But I felt like it represented a similar kind of haunting of past trauma that follows you when you're not independent, and then once you liberate yourself from whatever was keeping you enslaved, or I guess she wasn't physically freed, but she was mentally freed almost. The doppelganger or the twin didn't have a purpose anymore, which is obviously different than us, but very similar in a lot of ways.
It's interesting because when you're talking about, you know, the idea of twin and how she, like, appears and disappears when born out of trauma, disappeared out of healing, kind of, it seemed like.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think, is it a copy or an imitation? And this could go with us, too. Or is it, like, a split?
Yeah.
In a soul or being or personality?
Yeah.
And then once, like, born out of trauma, and then once, like, that's been reconciled,
mm-hmm.
is Twin, like, going back into Sorrow?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as, like, so she's not split anymore.
Right, because, like, it seems like the things that Twin would be saying sound like subconscious thoughts that you would think to yourself to, like, make yourself feel better.
Yeah.
That you would never share with anyone else.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if you were to write down all your subconscious thoughts, that would sound really creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would be thinking, like, oh, well, you know, she may, you know, you're better than them, or, like, whatever. Something like that that's,
yeah.
like, oh my gosh, that's terrible to think, but, like, whatever. You have to tell yourself that. And so, what is it, like, that split, like, she didn't have that?
Yeah.
Or, like, was she missing that element of, mm-hmm. like, making her whole? I don't know. That was
yeah.
just what my mind was thinking of when you're talking about that.
No, that definitely makes sense. And then I think of, you know, she gave birth and she took over agency over her own life.
Yep.
And that's how she kind of got rid of the split.
Right.
Versus in Us, they literally have to kill their doppelgangers.
Yeah.
And, like, what that means.
I mean, yeah, it's a very violent action.
Yeah.
But it's still an action.
Right, like, both are violent.
True.
Giving birth, the description of her giving birth
I'm
is
sure.
very violent.
I'm sure it was jarring.
And so it's just, you know, the difference between bringing life and then taking it.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know, the themes in Us, I don't really know why the only option was to kill the doppelgangers. Well, I guess the doppelgangers came up
they
to
kill. They wanted to kill them.
Right, and take over.
It posed as, like, it's either me or you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Type of situation.
Yeah, and the killing didn't really reconcile anything. It just replaced.
And I don't know if there was really healing at the end of Us, as there sounds like there was more healing at the end of that, for Sorrow, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
Because
definitely.
At the end of Us, I was left thinking, oh my goodness. Like,
it's even more broken than before.
It's even more broken than before.
Yeah.
And, like, also that question of, you know, when is everyone else going to figure that out? Or are they ever going to find out that Adelaide is
Red.
Not who she seems to be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And also, are they the only people alive?
Another great question.
Because it seems like it. It seems like they're the only ones left. And so where are you going?
Yeah, I don't know.
So many questions. Another thing that I thought was super interesting about both of these works was the time periods. And I watched / listened to an interview with Morrison of her talking about the time period of A Mercy in relationship with her characters and the races that she decided to depict.
You return to the subject of slavery, but in a very different way and in a very different era. We're talking about, as I said, the New World. This is really the early times in America. Why did you choose to go to that era to tell this story?
I wanted to separate race from slavery, to see what it was like, what it might have been like, to be a slave but at not without being raced, because I couldn't believe that that was the natural state of people who were A-born and people who came here, that it had to be constructed, planted, institutionalized, and legalized. One realizes that there was no civilization that did not rest on some form of enslavement, whether it was Athens or Moscow, or whether it was England or France. They called them different names, peons, serfs, what have you. But owning the labor of people was a constant in the world. So that was not the unusual thing. The unusual thing was coupling it with racism, which came much, much later.
And I think that totally, I mean, Us is clearly set in the present, but has a lot of undertones of the past, obviously, and represents that similar form of, not even post-racial, but like pre-racial. The idea that slavery and the underclass was an idea before it was attached to Black people.
Yeah.
And what that was like before, you know? Mm. And I think both, it seems like Morrison and Peele were exploring that idea of like, what if that concept of slavery and being in a place where you're owned by someone else or you have no way of moving up in the ladder wasn't so attached to race.
Yeah.
And like what that means.
That's interesting. And do you think that's why the rest of the Tethered, like it wasn't all just like Black people?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also Peele wanted to, I think he wanted to explore a story that could be expanded to a lot more people than Get Out was.
Right.
I guess no white person walking out of Get Out was like, I totally get yeah. what he was feeling. But I think his point was this could have been anyone. Like, slavery could have been anyone and could have been associated with anyone. It just happened to be Black people because of the time.
Yeah.
But, like, what if everyone was experiencing this form of like injustice and complete inhumane treatment?
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting idea. Because I think America, like part of the American story is race and is our relationship with
huge
slavery. And I don't think we would have the same story at all if it wasn't based in race. Yeah, so I guess what I wanted to finish on was a discussion about how both of these works speak to where we are right now as Americans and in the current period, which is a turbulent one. I guess what these works have to say about the relationship between the past and the present and the future. Also, in our class, a huge theme has been the kind of interchangeable nature of history. Like, a lot of the works that we've read are in present tense and in second person. Yeah. So a lot of texts will address the audience as you. In class, we talk a lot about how that is a strategy to invite someone in to that exact moment,
yeah.
that story. And also those authors and writers and directors and people are commenting on the fact that history isn't this set moment that ends. Like, history doesn't end as easily as we think. And Claudia Rankine, who is a poet that we read, describes this idea of a historical self and a self-self, and we think that we have different of those, you know? Like, we have our historical self that puts into context slavery and race and class and all of these things in, like, the bigger picture, and then we have this self-self that is us personally. But she says that we don't have two, we only have one. And we're always kind of thinking about our historical self and our self-self. And the historical self is what makes our self-self.
Interesting.
And so when I saw us and when I read A Mercy, it seemed like that, like, duality of the historical self and the self-self was very clear, in that, you know, there's not these two beings, there's only one, like, there's only one soul.
Yeah. It's also interesting with the idea of time.
Yeah.
Because the beginning of Us starts with the flashback, and so it's a previous point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And then much, much later in Adelaide's life, she's dealing with the trauma of that. And yeah. So it kind of, again, plays with that idea of, like, dealing with things again, mm-hmm. and over time, and how things will keep repeating.
Yep.
And especially with trauma.
Yeah.
I think dealing with that at any point, that yeah. will be a forever part of your life.
Definitely.
And it's a forever part of the history mm-hmm. of our country, at least.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I'm sure that's an obvious aspect, but
yeah.
that is something that comes to mind. Definitely. When you look at the movie as a grand scheme of the then and now. And again, I can't get that imagery out of the Hands Across America, because the government and, like, as I think also just right now with the political state of our country,
yeah.
and just that idea of the government implementing things and not caring about people of a lower class, or, like, people mm-hmm. of a minority.
Yeah.
And just, like, throwing away the people that don't matter, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And what that means and how that still keeps happening.
Yep.
In different forms. Another thing is that I feel like Us and A Mercy are both, like, an internal struggle, outside barriers, duality of self, all of that stuff, but externalized, and it's very scary and creepy to see. But, like, for, it kind of makes me think of just white privilege in general, the privilege of not having to think about those things.
Yeah.
And then when they're brought to surface, how scary that is.
Yeah.
But, like, that's a reality for so many people. And
yeah.
that's another aspect, I think, of the then versus now, like, of what it means today.
Yeah.
These stories.
And that no matter how long you run from them, and how long you deny that things happened in history, and that people have trauma, and that you have trauma, the more that it'll build up and eventually catch up with you. And I think that's the creepy part about Us, is that they're running from place to place.
Yeah.
And they know that the doppelgangers are coming, but they just have to run. And Adelaide's first reaction was to run.
Oh, yeah.
And whereas her husband's was to fight them.
Right.
And I think that represents the idea that she's been running for so long from the memory of being untethered and committing that switch,
yep.
that she is so paranoid that it's going to catch up with her, and it does.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even the last shot of them driving away, like, where are they going? You know, like,
right.
it's going to catch up with you.
There's no forgetting that. There's no moving forward, you know. She
yeah.
murdered
like yeah.
her own self.
Yeah,
in a,
they
in a way.
All did.
Right.
Yeah. And was that, I think it's really unclear whether that was a victory.
It didn't feel like a victory. It's so crazy too, and I think that's another thing that he was going for, is that you want to feel that relief,
yeah.
but you can't.
Yeah.
And even though it seems like everyone's safe now, they're not okay.
Yeah.
And there feels like an impending doom still.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they are safe forever. That,
right.
That's not a life you want to live.
Right. That's the same feeling that I had reading A Mercy, was there was no clean ending because no one was really free.
Yeah.
Like, they were all still slaves. Things were different, but still not good. And Florence is somewhat liberated, but also still very traumatized, maybe even more so than before. And so it's just, for me, it's the feeling of sadness for these characters, that they can't seem to escape whatever they're running from.
And the idea that it cannot be reconciled. Mm-hmm. It simply cannot be.
Yeah, yeah.
But that only time moving forward is the only thing that would make something better. But it's not really better.
Yeah.
It's just a little less recent.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, what do we have to do in the present to repair the past?
And can we?
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, there are things that have been done that it's irreparable.
Yeah.
But then, moving forward, how do you address that?
Well,
depressing ending.
Yes.
But, I mean,
it's true. That's America.
The depressing ending of both stories.
Yeah,
really.
Very true. I think we touched everything.
Yeah.
This has been Car Convos.
Car Convos.
We all have impending doom.
They don't always end the best ways.
That's our slogan. They don't always end the best.